This is Games as a Podcast.
So this week, we're joined by David Jagno. David is someone I've known for several years. Back after I stopped working at Sega, I was working for a little startup called Sidekick VR. We had a game called Protocol Zero, and David at the time was working at Upload VR and really helped me get visibility for that great little Samsung Gear VR game. David, welcome to the podcast, and if you can tell us a little bit about yourself, that would be great.
Yeah, of course. Thank you, Ethan. Like you said, my name is David Jagno, and I've been working in the VR industry for, I guess, coming up on 10 years or so now, which is kind of crazy to think about. I, like you said, started at Upload VR back before the Rift and the Vive were even out, back when it was just Cardboard and Gear VR stuff, and I've been in VR ever since. So the Rift, the Vive, PSVR, the touch controllers, you know, the various different Quest headsets and Go and all those different things. And I've worked at different companies over the years. I've been in journalism for a while. I used to review games at IGN and Forbes and other places like that. And I'm just, you know, lifelong gamer, been immersed in it. I love it professionally, personally. You know, I'm either talking about, writing about, or playing games pretty much all the time. So I imagine I fit right in with the two of you here. So thank you very much for having me. And I look forward to talking about some VR and games.
Good to have you for sure. And I know, David, that you're not just focused on VR as a gamer. You play everything, just like me and most of the people probably listening to this podcast. So,
yeah, that's absolutely right. I think, you know, for me, it's particularly funny because I find that a lot of people that are interested and passionate about VR are also the ones that are retro gamers. And I don't know what that correlation is necessarily, the fascination with the past and the excitement for the future. Like, there's a huge convergence there. And, you know, if I'm not in my VR headset, I'm probably playing on my Dreamcast or my Genesis, or I have my Saturn back here, my Super Nintendo N64, all that stuff's hooked up, you know, so I collect and I play everything. So I've created a utopia of gaming for my kids, which I think is what I always wanted. So that's, you know, kind of what I've done.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. And great that they're going to understand the history of games so they can contextualize how special the new stuff is as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
So should we talk about VR?
Let's talk about VR.
No, VR's dead.
VR has been on the cusp of breakout mass marketness for decades, it seems. But it's really cool to have you, David, someone who's been kind of on the front lines for probably a decade or more. And I'm a huge fan of the technology. It's super immersive, and I think enables new kinds of entertainment to be created and enjoyed. However, it certainly hasn't set the games industry on fire like I think many parties were hoping for it to be the next iPhone or something. But that doesn't mean there aren't really cool things being done, and there aren't any cool experiences to be had. So really welcome this time to talk to you and hear from you about your experiences.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. It's always an interesting time for VR because I feel like you said, it's always sort of been on the cusp of either death or greatness, depending on who you talk to. And I think, you know, we're at a point now where it's legitimately a pretty established medium that operates kind of outside of gaming, but also within gaming, and then also kind of outside of general computing, but also within general computing. And it crosses over into a lot of fields, and there's a lot of people that use it for different reasons. And I think, you know, having so many different players out there from, you know, the different Quest headsets to, you know, PC VR to PS VR. And, you know, I'm a fan of VR in general. And like I said earlier, I used to be a journalist covering it. And then I kind of switched sides, and I've been on the back end side working at different studios and tech companies since then. And just seeing how it's evolved and seeing how people talk about it differently. I've never prescribed to the sort of like quote unquote evangelist persona. I've never considered myself to be someone that's sort of a blind optimist. I always try to have a critical eye and have a certain degree of standards that I like to apply to not just gaming in general, but also VR gaming as well, because I think that's a sign of maturity that if you can, you know, have sort of expectations that are beyond just, oh, this is so cool, it's VR, that makes it awesome automatically. You know, I don't really believe in that sort of blind optimism. I like to, you know, I expect things to grow and improve and get better over time. And I think VR is kind of at that point now where, you know, we have the AAA releases coming out at the end of the year. We have the big new games. We have, you know, steady flow of releases throughout the year. We've got different platforms. We've got, you know, there's a lot of maturity in the field that wasn't there 8, 9, 10 years ago. So that's been really cool to see.
So do you feel that a medium where 12, upwards of 12, 15% of the people that use it experience motion sickness could ever be mass market? Or do you feel like the technology will get to a point where they can drive that problem down into the less than 5% realm?
Yeah, I think the technology is going to make a big impact there, because if you look at the severity and frequency of motion sickness type effects on people today versus, you know, whenever the Rift and Vive came out, I think there's, at least anecdotally, I've seen far less reports of that sort of thing, because I think as frame rates get better, resolution gets better, experiences design around, you know, those sort of considerations better, it seems like that is trending downwards from what I've seen. I think at the end of the day, there will still be people that get motion sick. I know I have some friends that personally can't play first-person shooters on a regular TV because they get motion sick. So I think, you know, there's always going to be people that are going to have that sort of reaction. But I think as the technology improves and as the experiences are designed around that mindset better, it'll be less frequent. I think, like, a good example is for the Quest, for example, because it's wireless and you can move around the room, usually it's less likely for you to get motion sick because the artificial movement isn't as intense in the game. You're able to physically move your body more, which kind of counteracts that response and the equilibrium. So I think we're getting to the point where it's less frequent, from what I've seen at least.
So one thing I've noticed is that it's a platform that has both enormous challenges from a friction standpoint and is at the same time remarkably accessible, depending on what you're playing and how you're using it. So one of the coolest experiences I had with VR was way back when I was first playing around with it, and I had the Samsung Gear VR. And we were on a vacation with my father-in-law, who at the time was just turning 80. And we put the Gear VR on his head, and we set up a Google Maps app that allowed him to just say the name of different addresses, and he was able to transport himself standing to different places he'd grown up. The old farmhouse that he grew up as a kid, and was so excited to see that, and took off the headset and insisted that my wife look at that so that she could see in a way she had never seen before where he grew up. And he was just so mesmerized by the fact that he could just say where he lived and magically he'd be transported there. And even though obviously it was very rough from visibility standpoint, the resolution wasn't fantastic, it still was a magical experience for him and something vastly more accessible than when I used to try to show him like Forza Motorsport or something that looked cool in photoreal that he had no interest in. So that to me was really eye-opening, just how accessible this could be. At the same time, there is the issue for more intense games where you're putting this thing on and it gets hot and sweaty. And for me anyway, in a townhouse, there's never enough space for room scale, right? Whether I'm downstairs or I am in my living room, there's always this better than good chance that I'll accidentally punch my big screen TV, right? That's something that I'm always worried about. When I worked in VR, I actually did run one of these expensive, nearly $300 Vive controllers right through the wall because it was a kind of Rock'em Sock'em robot game, and I just was losing track of where I am. So I always have to kind of be very careful thinking about guardrails, and all of that creates an experience that, while definitely unique, is just full of friction that doesn't exist when I just instead sit down with a controller and turn on my TV.
Right. It's a very appointment-based activity, right? You kind of have to be very deliberate in, I'm going to do this, and I had to set up my play space or put on the headset and make sure there's nothing that's going to hurt me or someone else.
Yeah, I think the guardrails have gotten a lot better. On Quest 3 especially, that it does a really nice job of remembering your rooms, you know, so like once you map a room, it'll remember where you put your guardrails based on which room you're standing in. And it'll even notify you if something new is in the play space that wasn't there when you mapped it. So like if you have...
Cat has entered the chat.
Yeah, exactly. So like if, you know, for example, I have a table in my living room that has wheels that we roll around to use for different things. And if I had moved it into the middle of the living room and put on the headset and forgot, you know, it would notify and be like, hey, there's something new in your play space. And so stuff like that's nice. And, you know, but like you said, there are certain considerations that you just have to have whenever you're going to be doing room scale VR that don't exist for a stationary, you know, like couch activity, like a regular game. And, you know, I think like you said, your space personally is limited. And, you know, that's just sort of one of those caveats and one of those, you know, areas where everyone's experience is going to be different. That's kind of what makes VR so unique and different is like, you know, everyone that has a PS5 and plugs it into an HDTV, they're going to be playing pretty much the same game, like maybe different size TVs, different resolutions, but their experience is mostly going to be the same. But in a VR game, you know, if I have a large garage that's wide open, empty, 30 by 30 space, you know, my experience playing a game where I run around and, you know, sword fight people is definitely going to be more immersive than someone that plays in a standing room only, you know, like closet of a space. And so that's it's interesting. It's very interesting for sure. And it poses interesting design challenges for developers to have to try to accommodate all of those different scenarios of where someone might try to play their game as well.
Yeah, not to mention the challenge of having to be, 90 frames a second to make sure that you're not getting people sick. So many cool solutions, foveated rendering, where it's like it can tell where your eye is looking and only put all the most important pixels there. There have been a lot of kind of cool solutions to make it work. And when it does work, this is something that I think is important to say right off the bat. It does create this otherworldly experience that delivers on all the promise that we hoped VR would. I wish there were more kind of AAA experiences in the world of VR, but the three that really knocked my socks off were the Half-Life Alyx game, which was so good that it was one of those rare experiences that once I finished it, I just started from the beginning and played all over again. I just couldn't believe how immersive and fun it was. Astrobot, which was on PlayStation VR, which like everyone loves the new Astrobot game, and it is great. It's my favorite game of the year so far, but that can't even compare to what it was like to play that game in VR. It was just like playing Mario, but being fully immersed in the world, and it was just fantastic. And then Resident Evil 7 scared the living shit out of me VR. These are the experiences that make me say VR is fantastic. Obviously, you can point to things like Beat Saber and some other really great games that have captured people's attention. But these games prove that it's not just a novelty. It's not just a different perspective. It is something that's truly unique and really is valuable to the art of games.
Yeah, those are three great examples. I definitely echo Resident Evil 7. That's a game that I use as an example of why sometimes being a game journalist was a lot more stressful than people realize. Getting that game code on like a Thursday night and having the review embargo be Monday morning. You know, a game that you physically are struggling to play because of how viscerally terrifying it is.
Yep.
And you have to force yourself through it because it's your job. It was a very unique experience because that's a game where like I literally had nightmares about that experience. And whenever you have a memory or a nightmare about a VR game, it's different because you're not remembering looking at a screen, you're remembering being there. And you know, that so some of the moments in that game are wild. I don't want to spoil it.
The terror is immersive.
Yeah, it truly is. Because you know, like you can't just look away. You know, you look away in VR and the thing is still behind you. It's worse than looking at it. And so there's no escape. It's just overwhelmingly suffocating and amazing. Amazing though. Like you said, like I can't say enough good things about it. And Resident Evil 8 on PSVR 2 is also great. The Resident Evil 4 VR remake on PSVR 2 and the Quest version of that one, also great. Horror and VR just go together so well.
Yeah, for sure. One of those perfect use cases. So, Chris, what would you say was like the most impactful thing you've experienced in VR?
Great question. So, as an old-timer, I remember waiting in line at the arcade to play Dactyl Nightmare.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Which kind of puts you up... Very large, goofy headset, not super high fidelity, but pretty immersive and probably sunk way too many quarters, maybe even dollars at that point. into it.
Yeah, that was Virtuality, right? That was the big headset.
Yes,
yeah.
It was Virtuality, the lawnmower man. That was kind of the first round of VR making a push for mass marketness. So Lawnmower Man, bless its heart, such a terrible movie. But
quick aside, I worked at a video store when I was in college, and I got to personally witness the time where we got these little black stickers, and we were required to put those stickers over the name Stephen King on all of the Lawnmower Man boxes because he was so upset with how that movie turned out as an adaptation of one of his short stories that became a requirement.
Yeah, he would have liked to have done that for The Shining too, which yes. Of course would right. be a mistake.
Yeah, that is stepping back because I remember even the Sega Genesis, they were toying with the idea of a VR headset.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the Sega, I think Sega VR is what it was called, less I recall.
Yeah, and that probably was not going to be running at 90 frames a second. So.
I don't think so.
That'd be a slideshow.
More recently, I got to check out the Vive. A buddy of mine worked at Unity, and they had a demo kit, and I went over and just played Tilt Brush literally for an hour.
Yeah, beautiful game.
Just amazing, and the demo of the whale kind of swimming around.
Oh, the blue, yeah.
The blue, yeah, just amazing. I was just struck with how fundamentally different a mode of entertainment it was. You know, obviously, those aren't gaming experiences, but immediately saw kind of the potential it had for those. And then I had a PSVR, and I loved Job Simulator. It's just fun, quirky. And I haven't played Alex, which I really want to play and will play at some point. The Job Simulator was really fun. Don't keep talking and no one explodes. I thought was really good.
Ooh, yeah.
Especially because it allowed people who didn't have the headset on to enjoy the experience as well. So I thought that was a really good design to bring people into the VR experience in some meaningful way. Really good party game, really, really good. And everyone gets a chance to kind of have the headset on and experience the VR without kind of alienating everyone else in the room. So I thought that's a pretty great design. But yeah, the technology is amazing. It's obviously come a long way in a short time, thanks to Zuckbucks, and hopefully we'll continue to do so.
Well, David, I can only imagine among the three of us, you have the most comprehensive experience in playing everything. So I'd be really interested in knowing also what you would say are like your top three or five games.
For me, the first... I guess I'll say modern VR because like you mentioned, you know, there was a previous era of VR that kind of predates my experience with games. But my first modern VR wow moment was playing a Crytek demo on the Oculus Crescent Bay dev kit at GDC one year.
Oh,
that was the moment that really like was my aha moment where I realized like, okay, this is where I want my career to go. And it was a demo where you played as a little baby dinosaur hatching out of an egg. And it was purely just like a 3D movie, like an immersive movie. There were no controller interactions or anything. But you watch from the point of view of a dinosaur emerging from an egg and having the parent dinosaur over you. And that sense of scale was just completely mind-blowing. It completely just, you know, altered my brain chemistry in that moment. And then I think maybe a year or two later at E3, there was a demo for Eve Valkyrie, the like flight combat game. And whenever I tried that, it really was crazy to me because, you know, when I'm flying the jet, you know, shooting at other ships and everything in space, like a typical space dogfighting combat game. But then the demo attendee explains, oh, you can move your head to lock onto targets while you're flying. And that was just like, wow, hold on. There's like a third analog stick here because I can move my head around. And, you know, so that was amazing. I loved that game. That was a super, super fun game. And then Skyrim VR, fully modded on PC, is probably my favorite VR experience to date still.
Oh, wow.
Because Skyrim's already one of my favorite games of all time. I'm a huge Bethesda fanboy. And getting to actually set foot inside Tamriel and having all the mods that really supercharge that game to make it as VR-ified as it can be. You know, there's mods for that allow you to like physically pick up every object, to physically equip items on your belt and, you know, put your shield and arrows behind your back. And I mean, you can mod that game to death. And in VR, it is pure magic. I mean, I really want to get a VR treadmill just for Skyrim VR so I can walk across Tamriel and see how long it takes to go from like the College of Winterhold all the way down to, you know, the different cities and stuff. Yeah, I love Skyrim VR. I can't say enough good things about it. And then I would say kind of recently, other than Batman's obviously great, Star Wars Squadrons.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's an incredible, incredible VR game, especially if you play that with a like a HOTAS on a desk on your PC, and you just really, you know, get the throttle and everything and the you know control stick all set up. I put my father-in-law on that. He's not a gamer at all, but he loves Star Wars. And so I put him in an X-Wing cockpit for the first time, and the look on his face was, you know, purely priceless. Like you said about your father-in-law, like getting to see him, his reaction to flying an X-Wing for the first time, like he was over the moon, and it was, you know, it was really cool to see. That Star Wars Squadrons is highly, highly underrated.
You know, one advantage of a game like that is when you're watching the movies, you see everyone's wearing a helmet. And so having something on your head feels natural in that case, that weight.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think, oh, just one other thing about Star Wars Squadrons, I think is it's a game that you don't really need to explain very much, because I think with VR, there's a lot of games like Skyrim is a good example where you need to take a collegiate level course to explain the controls.
Yes.
And with Star Wars Squadrons, you know, if anyone's ever seen a flight stick, if they've ever seen a throttle, you know, they will intuitively understand, especially because that cockpit probably has a throttle and stick in it already. So once they put the headset on, they're going to know, like you pull back on the throttle to go up, you know, you pull the trigger to shoot. You don't have to explain it to them. And so I think that removes that barrier, that friction, you know, similar to a driving simulator game like Gran Turismo. You know, you give someone a wheel, they understand how to use it. And so I think that made it even more powerful, because I didn't have to spend 20, 30 minutes explaining to him what each button does. He can just sit down, fly the X-Wing, shoot the TIE fighters. He's good to go.
Yeah, it also helps when the experience is seated, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So the locomotion has always been a challenge. I remember one of the more clever ways around that. I was playing a game, I think it was maybe branded with Walking Dead, but they had a workaround where you were seated in a wheelchair, which actually felt much better, because that smooth motion that is not like walking, your brain could kind of accept that and deal with the locomotion better. I don't like the transport locomotion a lot of games use. I know that for a lot of people, that just is much more comfortable. What are your thoughts on the different ways people can move in these games, the different solutions?
Yeah, the teleporting became very popular for a while. I was never a fan of it. I know that some people, you know, really need something like that, because, you know, any smooth movement will cause them to get queasy. So I'm glad it exists for people like that. I've also seen it referred to as blink movement, because the screen typically flickers like you're blinking your eye, kind of. It's kind of simulates that. One of the movement types that I've seen that I actually like a lot when it works well, but it seems like it's hard for devs to get it to work correctly, is like whenever you move your arms, kind of, maybe you hold a button on the controller and you move your hands like you're walking or running to simulate movement. And depending on the game, I think that can be pretty nice. Like, for example, there's the NFL Pro Era. So whenever you're scrambling as a quarterback, you do that movement with your hands to kind of run. And that feels good, because, you know, that's kind of what you would do in that moment anyway.
Yeah, when I was in production, we called that ski pole moving. It's like...
Yeah, I think one of the first games I saw do that was Sprint Vector. That was a game where the entire game was sprinting, like it was a racing game. Mm-hmm. It was essentially Mario Kart, but you're sprinting in VR, basically. It was a pretty cool one. It was one of the first examples I'd seen of the arm swinger movement. And if you play on PC VR, they have like plugins and mods where you can inject different movement systems into different VR games. One of the pretty popular ones is like I think it's called V Rocker, where you sort of like attach like a Vive tracker to your hip and you like jog in place and you can detect your movement.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, stuff like that's neat, but extra peripherals are always kind of a pain. But yeah, I think for the most part, it seems like a lot of AAA style games are just going fully into the smooth movement realm. kind of like I was saying earlier, the better frame rates and resolutions and foveated rendering, like you said, and the FOV dimming whenever you're moving or blurring the sides whenever you turn. Like there's a lot of things devs can do to limit the sickness.
Yep.
So like, for example, Batman is a game where it's smooth movement. You know, that's how Asgard's Wrath 1 and 2 are. That's how Batman is. I think Walking Dead Saints and Sinners is smooth movement only. That might have teleport. I can't remember. But a lot of games are going that realm now where it's just, you know, you have a control stick on the controller, you use it to move. You know, it takes some getting used to for some people for sure.
Well, and I will say, even in the optimal scenario where you're playing a seated experience like Valkyrie, you can still get sick. I remember feeling nauseous playing that game.
Yeah.
But then thinking, I'm not going to actually get sick. That's kind of an old wives' tale, right? But then as I started to do loop-de-loops in that game, I actually did throw up. That was the one and only time where I threw up playing a game. And I have a pretty sturdy stomach with these types of experiences. You can really throw your mind for a loop.
Yeah, arguably that just makes it extremely realistic, right?
Yep. 'Cause
I guess in a real cockpit, that might happen to people. So
yeah, for sure. So the other thing I wanted to ask about was as far as room scale versus seated as well. I know that there was always this debate as to what should be the way to play VR. Because when Oculus originally came out, if you remember, most experiences were seated. And then Vive was pushing for this room scale experience. And Valve also really wanted people to experience things that way. What do you guys think?
Kind of what David was saying. It's a bit of a challenge for the industry in terms of there's not really a standard. There's so many different ways to experience the game. So I think that that's kind of ultimately limiting for a studio anyways. If you want to appeal to the most number of players or customers, you kind of have to consciously pare down the design. The room scale designs or games that are designed for room scale are kind of almost definitionally way more immersive because you are more engaged in interacting with this virtual space because you can move around and you're less likely to get sick because you're moving and your brain fills in the gaps a lot easier. And then you also have these companies that have designed areas where you can go and shoot at people in 3D spaces in VR, which I think is kind of elevates it to another level of immersion because you can interact with other players in meet space, and then you also can have practical effects that also lend more realism. So theme parks also kind of taking some pages out of those books as well with some of the rides that they design that are VR-like, if not quite downright VR. Just speaks to the many different experiences that can be created and enjoyed. Obviously, the ultimate one is kind of room scale for a consumer angle anyways, even though not everyone has the space to do it. But room scale is pretty amazing.
Yeah, and David, I know you lived as an editor through that kind of battle in terms of what the best way is. So where do you land on that?
Yeah, I think there's definitely benefits to both, with the caveat that it has to be at the center of the design for the experience. Yeah. You know, I think if you take a game that should be played room scale and then play it seated, you're going to just inherently remove a lot of the immersive potential. It's a great accessibility option, you know, if someone physically can't walk or if they don't have the space, obviously, like, you know, giving them the ability to play seated is great. But I think if a game is designed for room scale, it's just inherently going to feel better to play it standing up, moving around. But I do think there are plenty of examples of games that are played seated that can still feel incredibly immersive. I think Demio is a great example. You know, it's a game that is essentially simulating a tabletop D&D experience. So you're going to be seated anyway. So you don't feel like you're losing out on anything, especially if you play it in mixed reality. I think that's kind of the new realm that we're getting to with the Quest 3 is those pass-through cameras on the front of the headset. Kind of to your point, Ethan, earlier about, you know, obstacles in your room and not having a ton of space. Playing a game mixed reality makes it so that you can always see your environment. Mm-hmm. So you're less likely to hit something and the game adapts to your space. You know, there's games out there where you map your room, you tell it where the walls are, where the ceiling is, where your objects are, like your couches and tables, and then the game will adapt to the space you provided. You know, for example, having creatures hide under a table or like a zombie breaking through the wall and coming into your room. There are mixed reality games now that take into account the space you have and adapt to that size, which I think is really cool. There's a lot of games now that are kind of tech demo type experiences for the mixed reality environment. But we're finally getting to the point where there's like full-fledged games as well. Like there's one that recently came out called Starship Home. And that one is a full mixed reality game where it turns your room into like a rocket ship. You go to space and then it cuts out portals in your walls to go to different planets and, you know, like get different plants and animals and visit different areas. And then, you know, your room becomes like a terrarium for alien life. And it's so cool because I love mixed reality stuff because it changes the world around you and it brings the game into your world, which is just truly next level to me. There's a lot of cool stuff like that out there now, which is really nice.
And that's a great segue into something that I'd love to talk about is looking into the crystal ball. Is AR, MR kind of the path to mass market adoption? So you saw Meta introduce their new AR, MR kind of glasses, very chunky, Buddy Holly on steroids type, $10,000 dev kits. Is that the future in your mind?
Yeah, I think we'll get to a point where something like that will be pretty mainstream. I think the Ray-Ban Metas are already doing a pretty good job for the smart glasses market. You know, a lot of people preach about how much they love having video recording and AI on their face. It's a neat product for sure. The Orion glasses, like you mentioned from Kinect, I think that sort of form factor has definitely got to be the goal because the Quest and other VR headsets, you know, I don't think anyone's going to wear a device like that out walking around.
Not in downtown San Francisco, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Ready Player One, so who knows? I guess we could have people, you know, Master Chief armor running down the street, you know, one day. A lot of people seem to think that VR is just like a gateway drug to AR, and I think it's going to be too, you know, pretty defined markets. Like, I think, you know, AR, to me, doesn't have as much appeal for games. I'm much more interested in VR and mixed reality, you know, because AR glasses, I don't see like holograms being something that I want to play with as much if I could instead become Batman, you know, for example. You know, who knows? Maybe there will be a Flappy Bird moment for AR glasses one day and everyone will suddenly love it.
Have we had that moment, though, maybe with Pokemon Go?
Yeah, I mean, calling that AR to me is that's like that really blurs the line.
It's more location-based gaming than AR, I would say.
I don't know anyone that uses the camera features of Pokemon Go when they play it, for example. I don't consider superimposing a 3D model on top of your camera feed to really be AR. I think that's definitely blurring the line for me.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting, too, that was not a repeatable phenomenon. You put Jurassic Park or Harry Potter or Minecraft on that foundation and it doesn't work.
Yeah, not even Minecraft can capitalize on a trend, then that's interesting.
Yeah, for sure. One other thing I really want to talk about also is mobile VR, because at the start that seemed to be what a lot of people were figuring was going to be the gateway drug, the thing that would really get people into it. Google was super excited about Cardboard, and I myself remember my very first experience with VR was with Google Cardboard, which was a Seinfeld concert, and it just put you in the audience, and you were sitting and watching, and I practically felt like I had a beer in my hand. It was just like such an immersive and fun thing to be in a nightclub simply by putting these goggles on and holding them to my face, and yet, despite all the efforts that Samsung put into a Gear VR headset with every phone sold, it seems like that has just disappeared entirely. And it was such a neat idea. What the hell happened to that? And why does it not exist anymore?
Yeah, I think for me, like the Gear VR was my first VR head. Well, other than Cardboard, it was my first VR headset that I got for my Samsung phone. I think it just kind of got to a point where people don't like having to use their smartphone with other devices and tie up the use of their phone to use another device. Mm. At least for me personally, I know that was the case. It tended to, you know, overheat or, you know, drain the battery super fast and then I can't use my phone. And
for sure.
And also just the friction of having to plug it in and then make sure like the app launches correctly and make sure that, you know, the lenses are correct. And I don't know. I think there was just a lot of hoops to jump through to properly get into a Gear VR experience. A lot of people already have their phones on them, obviously, and so it just plugging it into a headset made sense, I think, on paper. But I think in terms of like actual functional, actionable devices, having a standalone makes a lot more sense. And I think the Oculus Go was a good example of that. It was essentially a Gear VR without a phone. and it was incredibly popular. I know a lot of people that loved using that for concerts, for, you know, media watching, for all that kind of stuff. And the Quest has kind of cannibalized the need for a separate device like that because it already does all those things. So I think the core of that idea is still there with Quest because it is a standalone mobile VR. It's just, it does so much more as well. But yeah, I loved the gear for whenever I had it. One of the games that I was initially addicted to was Smash Hit. I don't know if you ever played that on Gear VR. It was essentially like playing Breakout or, you know, like a block breaker game, but you kind of used your face to bounce the ball.
Oh, cool.
And it was so fun. Oh my gosh, it was incredible. I loved it.
Yeah, you just mentioned the kinds of applications that are not games that can be really enjoyed in VR. And I wanted to talk about that for a little bit because one of my best experiences in VR was in Altspace VR.
Oh, yeah.
During the announcement of the Apple iPhone X, I watched that in what felt like an IMAX room with a group of techie nerds, some of which were hecklers that just loved Android devices, others that were like big time fanboys of Apple. And it was a very friendly, fun experience. It was like what I would imagine going to the bar to watch the Super Bowl for Sportos was like for nerds, right? And was actually a pretty cool experience, something unlike anything I'd ever done before. That showed me that social could be really meaningful and exciting in VR. And also watching movies. The first time I saw John Wick, I sat in what felt like a true movie theater, right? Complete with the leather seats and popcorn that was virtual.
Oh, yeah. Was that in big screen?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that was super, super cool to me, too, because I'm the type of moviegoer that wants that type of complete immersion when I'm watching a movie. So what are the non-gaming stuff that you guys have enjoyed in VR?
Well, I'd mentioned Tilt Brush before. That was super, super interesting and compelling. Even though I'm not an artist, it was still fun to kind of almost takes you back to kindergarten or something, just because the joy of art and just movement, very, very fun. I checked out Cardboard and I thought it was pretty interesting. And it's certainly, I think, a good gateway VR experience to introduce someone just so they can kind of see what it kind of points at the potential, because it's not as immersive as VR itself. To me, I kind of found it to be like a glorified ViewMaster almost, because it's very passive. You're looking at things, albeit a pretty immersive kind of 3D type experience. But in terms of non-gaming VR applications, I think Tilt Brush was probably my favorite of the bunch. But I admittedly haven't dived too deeply into
that. Yeah, those are great shouts for sure. I think Tilt Brush is one of those ones that is immediately intuitive and magical for pretty much anyone. I think there's a reason why it was so popular for Vive. Yeah, I love Tilt Brush. Kind of going the boring, kind of bland answer is there's a lot of productivity use cases for VR as well. Like there's this one app called Immersed that's really cool that allows you to set up like virtual screens and everything around you, which is nice, you know, for, you know, like streaming your computer to your headset, or, you know, increasing, you know, how many screens you have around you, or, you know, being able to, you know, like work from the moon or something like that. It's kind of like taking your big screen theater experience, but turning it into your office, you know, stuff like that is neat. I've done those experiences before kind of as a novelty. I don't think the comfort and resolution is quite there yet for me personally to actually want to do that as a replacement for my monitor. I know some people swear by it already. They already spend entire work days in VR. I'm not there yet personally. As someone that wears glasses, I feel like my eyes aren't able to get close enough to the lenses to where I can really appreciate that kind of stuff. You know, I don't use prescription lenses in my VR headset because I use the headset with family and stuff like that. I don't want to have to take them out and, you know, swap it out and everything. There's certainly some interesting use cases already that go beyond just games. You know, so, like you said as well, Ethan, like social stuff is amazing. I think, you know, VR Chat has some incredible experiences. Altspace is great. Horizon Worlds has a lot of cool stuff. Those are the kind of things that I like to take people into if they just recently got a headset. And I'm not quite sure what kind of game they would like yet. I would take them into one of those experiences and tell them like, oh, hey, meet me in this world or meet me at this place. And we'll, you know, chat and see what kind of stuff you might like. Kind of like if you are meeting a friend at a city, like, oh, let's meet downtown. Then we'll figure out where to go from there. you know, it's the VR version of that, which is kind of nice.
Well, when I was working at the VR startup, actually, we would use VR chat for our team meetings.
Oh, yeah.
Because it had this great sense of presence. Mm-hmm. And what was really cool about that is you're seated, but the characters that you are embodying gesticulate while you talk. And it's this like really natural thing. It goes kind of to the beat of what you're saying. So it feels good. It feels very natural. And it was kind of cool to say, oh, okay, we're going to take a meeting on the moon today. We're going to do traditional boardroom today, that type of thing.
Yeah, definitely. We've had a lot of team meetings in VR too. We used to, whenever I was at Upload VR, they still do this. Their podcast that they film and record and stream is all done in VR. One of the team members at Upload created their own, like, essentially new studio in Unity. And they have a screen where they can show trailers and screenshots of whatever they're talking about. They have their avatars, you know, it has hand tracking, you know, all the lip syncing is there. They can bring guests in as long as you have a quest, like, hey, just put the quest on, we'll send you an invite, you can hop in. So it's like having a news show, you know, someone is outside of VR controlling the cameras. And they're all in VR talking and having a full podcast experience, but from inside VR, basically, which is pretty cool.
That is very cool. Now, one thing that does make me a little bit nervous about the future of VR is when you look at something like PlayStation VR 2, which I spent $550 on. David, I know you bought it as well. It is absolutely phenomenal hardware, from the controllers to the room scale experience. Really, really great stuff. And when you're playing the Horizon game, it's just so beautiful and immersive and really speaks to what VR gaming can be. But that is literally the only first-party game, to my knowledge, that Sony ever produced for this expensive $550 device. And it seems like there's very little support from third parties for it now. What the hell happened?
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. I think, like you said, the hardware is amazing. I love my PSVR 2. You know, there's a lot of games that if they come to multiple platforms, PSVR 2 a lot of the time is the platform I'll pick just from a fidelity and, you know, feature-rich standpoint. I love the controllers. The haptics are great. The eye tracking, all that kind of stuff in the headset's amazing. And also the rumble in the headset is very cool. I think that's something a lot of people forget about is the headset has haptics as well. Depending on the experience, that can really elevate things. Like, for example, Firewall Ultra was a PSVR 2 shooter. I worked at the studio First Contact that developed that game. Mm-hmm. And whenever you would load into a match and put on like night vision goggles, you would feel the little vibration of the headset just very subtly. Stuff like that is so cool. Like it's all in the details when it comes to immersion like that. And I think, you know, having those kind of haptics that are really precise are really, really special for VR. So I'm very hopeful and optimistic that we will continue to see investment and interest from Sony, hopefully, because I think, you know, they have a lot of talent in their different studios that I would just love to see what those studios would do with VR. You know, like I would love, like, what would Naughty Dog make if they were asked to make a VR game? What would a new Astrobot game look like? So many studios and properties, like Insomniac. Insomniac made several VR games for Meta, for Oculus back in the day. Stormland, one of the best co-op VR shooters ever made. I think Unspoken, super fun Magic Combat game. Like, they made a lot of great VR stuff. So I would love to see them make something for PSVR 2 one day, hopefully. So I think, you know, there's a lot of talent there and there's a lot of interest, it seems like, from developers, at least historically. So I'm very hopeful and, you know, crossing my fingers that we get to see more because there's been some really good stuff.
If Insomniac has created these amazing experiences in the past, why is it, do you think, that they aren't currently or plan? I mean, I guess we don't know what they're planning necessarily, but we certainly haven't heard anything about it. Do you think it was just disappointing from a sales perspective or Sony is just redirecting them? I have a theory. Video game development is becoming ever more expensive, and I think publishers have to recoup their investments as much as possible, obviously, because that's what they're in business doing. So I feel we're rapidly moving out of the kind of platform exclusivity zone. So for Sony to decide to spend money on developing exclusively for their PlayStation VR 2 platform or 3, either need to constrain the scope of such things, which obviously limits the wow factor unless you're able to do some smart development, or they need to recoup their investment by putting it out on other platforms to include, you know, Quest and other competitive VR platforms.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it, especially if you see how quickly PlayStation games are making their way to Steam nowadays. You know, VR is an avenue where what I've seen some publishers do, for example, Capcom has been very good about this with the past three Resident Evil games, you know, with 7, 8, and 4, releasing the games, you know, as fully playable, functional, non-VR games, but then having VR as an add-on. You know, that's something that I think has a lot of potential for some of the AAA studios out there, because they might not want to roll the dice and gamble on making a full AAA VR exclusive game. You know, that might be seen as too risky for a lot of publishers. So what they could do is offer an add-on that allows players to play the game VR, even if they, you know, if they have a VR headset, or they could play it non-VR if they don't. I think that's an option. The caveat to that is it's very important that it is designed in a way that is truly VR, not just an add-on where you play from the first-person point of view, then the rest of the game is basically the same. There has to be, you know, some effort put into, for lack of a better term, VRifying things so that it, you know, feels like it was built with VR in mind. That's so important, because I think there were some early adaptations years ago that did not kind of take that to heart. For example, if a game is very heavily menu driven, it does not feel good in VR to sit there and, you know, have a laser pointer at menus over and over and over. For the game experience flow to kind of incorporate a lot of those elements, it doesn't feel good in VR. So there needs to be, you know, some work put in to adapt things. I think that is an avenue for some publishers, because they don't have to make an entirely new game from the ground up. The PSVR 2 Horizon game was really fun. I liked it a lot. I think it's frustrating for some fans, because, you know, maybe they wish they could have played that experience without the VR headset.
Yeah.
To that point, complete caveat, complete counterpoint, the new Batman game, for example, is a new Arkham game set in the Arkham universe, takes place between Origins and Asylum. You know, it's a fully canon Arkham game. It's the same universe, everything, but it is exclusive to the Quest platform.
Yep.
You know, so I think some fans were disappointed and upset about that. But at the same time, you know, it's not like this is a game that was being made and then they shifted to make it VR only. This is a game that wouldn't exist if it wasn't for the version that we got. You know, it's not like this was a game that was conceptualized and then adapted. This was a game that was always meant to be a VR game. And so I think for me, those are always usually the ones that turn out the best. Clearly, the review scores speak for themselves. It seems like a lot of people love this game. It's kind of a double-edged sword in a way, because, you know, there's publishers, you know, if they want to roll the dice and take the risk, I think trying to hit as many VR platforms as they can is not a bad idea. But also, if you do want to just add on to your non-VR game with a VR mode, that is an avenue that Capcom has been finding success with. So I would love to see more publishers do that as well. Like, I mean, if we could play the Call of Duty campaign in VR, that'd be amazing. Like, I would love that. So Activision, if you're listening, you know, that's a great idea.
The only challenge I've seen personally with that is playing Resident Evil 4, it has to constantly cut between the cutscenes, which are presented like as a 2D movie screen, and the 3D action.
Yeah.
And that to me is very jarring. That feels like a compromise that you don't get in something like Batman or Half-Life Alyx, because those games are made natively.
To that point, though, one of the reasons why it's so prevalent in that game is because that was previously a third-person game.
Yes.
So a lot of the cutscenes, you can't just have you watching the action from first-person point of view like you could with a typically first-person game that's adapted to VR. I think third-person can work in VR, and they decided to port that to first-person for Resident Evil 4. That's a tricky part that you run into whenever there's cutscenes and pre-rendered stuff that's in third-person. Unless you remake it entirely, there's not really a way around that.
So David, you probably are one of the best people to ask this question. Who is today the audience for VR? Are they just hyper-tech people that have 7 different headsets that they've collected over time? Is it mostly newer people? Or is there no kind of consistency in terms of who these folks are nowadays?
I'm not sure there is a lot of consistency, because I feel like, you know, you have the hardcore VR people like myself that play everything. But then a lot of the time, like, I'll meet, you know, my wife's mom's friend has a Quest because she loves Supernatural. You know, she works out in VR, but she would never touch Batman. And then I've got my other friends who are just pure gamers. They got a Quest just to play Batman, Assassin's Creed, Walking Dead. You know, those are the games that they care about. And then there's also the overlap where it's obviously like anyone that has a VR headset has probably tried Beat Saber at this point or very close to that amount of people that maybe they are interested in playing, I don't know, a boxing game, or maybe they want to try out this other type of experience. Like Just Dance just came out in VR. It's nice because I feel like there's enough variety in the genres and types of games and experiences out there that it's very hard for me to think of a type of person that I wouldn't recommend a Quest to. You know, I think we're kind of reaching that point where whether you want to use it for media viewing or rhythm games or exercise or traditional games, like, no matter what it is, I feel like there are very few people out there that I don't think would enjoy a Quest at this point. You know, I think it's one of those headsets that I can recommend without caveats, because I think previously it was not the case. It was like, okay, do you have a $1,000 gaming computer? Do you have room for base stations? Do you have room for cameras in your room that you want to set up? Do you have, you know, do you have all this space, or like, do you want to get another headset to play these VR games? There were so many different caveats involved, but now we're kind of at the point where it's like, well, you know, there's so much out there in VR that it's hard to not think you'd enjoy it.
Yeah, I remember about 8 years ago, I bought a PC and it had a little label that said Oculus Ready.
Oh, yeah, I remember those. Yeah,
I remember some people being kind of disappointed when there was a move over to the kind of Quest or Meta headsets that were self-sufficient as opposed to being attached, because obviously there are some technical advantages to being tied to a very expensive computer. But it does seem to make sense. And now with a game like Batman, I think you're seeing games graphically that are just really gorgeous that don't require being connected to a large computer.
Yeah, some of the stuff that comes out, it blows my mind that what developers are able to accomplish on Quest hardware. I think Quest 3 especially, games like Batman that are Quest 3 exclusive, you know, we're finally at a point where like a mobile standalone VR game can have things like, you know, good lighting and shadows and, you know, like textures that look really nice, whether you're close or far away, and having multiple enemies around you at a time, and real, just truly immersive stuff that doesn't have to make sacrifices in terms of the visuals necessarily. So it's exciting to be reaching that point, because I know for a while it was always, you know, like you could put screenshots side by side of something on PC VR and then the Quest version, and it was very obvious, you know, where the downgrades were made. But I think the hardware and the just sheer power is finally getting pretty good for mobile hardware. Quest is in a similar boat where I think it's the Snapdragon processor, like the stuff that they have inside under the hood is quite powerful nowadays.
So the two startups that I was at that were focused on VR are no more. And they were pretty small teams. One was literally a four-person team, the other was about 12 people. Is this a viable market for developers at any scale right now? That, I think, is a challenging question. I obviously am weighted to think one way because of what I've experienced, but are there teams that are able to survive without being owned by one of these major companies that can continue to pump out VR games? Because it is a specialty. It's something that you really have to be good at to do well and to make native VR games. Is it possible as a developer?
Yeah, I think it certainly is possible. I think it would be disingenuous for me to say no, because there are several publishers and developers that are entirely VR focused that are finding success. Like Resolution Games is a good example. They have new games coming out right now. There's one called Spatial Ops that's kind of like a shooter game. They've, you know, developed and released several different VR-only games. Some of them they've adapted to non-VR, like Demio, one of the ones I mentioned earlier, is kind of a cross-platform, cross-play sort of experience. But they've found a lot of success in VR. Some of the other ones have sort of made one game that they've continued to update and iterate on and just really expand their audience. Like Walkabout Mini Golf from Mighty Coconut is a good example. They release new courses all the time. They do like different brand partnerships and licenses. They have a course based on the Labyrinth movie, for example, that's incredible. They have all different kinds of courses in that game. Everyone loves that game. Golf Plus is another good one. And then do you have other games where like Servios is a studio that's been making VR games since the Rift and Vive days. They're still around. Skydance has really kind of embraced VR a lot as well with their Walking Dead game and now Behemoth that's coming out soon. So there's a lot of studios out there that have found success. And, you know, some of them are still very small, too. You have, for example, the folks that made Guerrilla Tag. Guerrilla Tag exploded in popularity. And there's been a lot of copycats of that one. So not every successful VR developer has to be acquired to survive. Just like in regular gaming, though, that there's a lot of noise and there's a lot of saturation. If you release a game on Steam, there's hundreds of games on Steam every day. So it's kind of at a point where VR isn't quite to that point yet. Like just on the Quest store, there's not that many releases yet. You know, it's about finding your audience and figuring out what niche you're really passionate about making a game in. There's a lot of examples out there of studios and developers and publishers that have, you know, continued to have success in VR. But for each one or two of those, there's going to be two or three failures as well. And I think that's not just a case in VR, though. That's kind of the industry as a whole.
That's games, baby.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, so David, I know that there was a push for Metaverse for a while that got people excited about VR again, which does lead me to kind of just a broader question, whether or not Metaverse becomes a thing. Live service, that's something that has would be kind of tied to Metaverse thematically or structurally. Yet when I jumped into VR, it was very much like premium only experiences. Does live service or Metaverse type experiences seem like something that will come to fruition on VR platforms?
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, the concept of the quote unquote Metaverse is something that's kind of, you know, nebulous. And I think it's a term that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. You know, I think for me, like if you were to look up kind of like the dictionary definition of what like the Metaverse is, everything online is part of the Metaverse, you know, like it is the internet, essentially. Mm-hmm. I think what a lot of people imagine is a world where you put on a VR headset and you are like Ready Player One style, you know, you're on a world and you can go to a different world, go to school, go to work, go to play a game. Everything's this interconnected kind of mesh of digital stuff. I don't know if we'll ever...
Or like the holodeck.
Yeah, or like the holodeck. Yeah, I don't know what how far away that is necessarily. I'm not sure. You know, sort of like a digital citizenship sort of like Metaverse concept is... that's something that people other than me are deliberating on, I guess you could say. The Metaverse already exists as far as I'm concerned. It's just not in the form that I think futurists and, you know, like sci-fi people are imagining for the future.
So you see kind of Fortnite as Metaverse, I'd assume, or Roblox?
Yeah. I think all those things are part of the Metaverse, you know, in the kind of base kind of sort of conceptual level.
Fair enough. Like in a let's go to a concert kind of way that is happening already.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the Meta 3 specifically, you know, and the Quest line has a huge advantage in being portable. And by that, I mean, like, if you go on vacation, you can take this tiny device with you and have a giant screen to play in your hotel room. Any games you want or movies you want to watch, if you're particularly brave, you can even use it in the airplane. There's a lot of convenience to that where you're not tied down and you can bring that thing anywhere and show people easily. I know that, like, the challenge with the Apple Vision Pro is you would have to get very specific appointments to see it, and the lenses have to be equipped to what your prescriptions are. And I know a couple that bought two of those just because they didn't want to have to swap out the lenses and do all the things that you need to have that optimal experience. Whereas something like the Meta 3 allows you to just have your own glasses, and that's a super convenient thing too. But I think they've solved a lot of the friction issues and have made it something you can carry around pretty easily.
Doesn't quite fit in your pocket like a phone, but yes.
Because it depends on the size of the pocket, right?
That's true. Maybe there's a fashion opportunity there. I think we're getting towards the end of our time, but David, did you want to give any kind of final thoughts as we wind down?
Yeah. Thank you very much for having me on. I really enjoyed chatting with both of you. And VR is in a very interesting spot. Like I kind of said at the beginning, you know, we've reached a point now where I feel like there's probably a VR experience or game out there for pretty much anybody. I think, you know, whenever I have someone over that hasn't tried a VR headset before, it's very easy for me to figure out based on what I know about the person, what they might be impressed by. And I think that's a nice place to be in, because even with regular games that I'm not really at that point, because, you know, there's plenty of people in my life where I know they just don't like video games. They don't like holding a controller or whatever. But whenever it comes to VR, like on Quest, for example, with hand tracking and the mixed reality features, it just removes a lot of the barrier to get someone to experience something and really find the magic. I think, you know, hand tracking, especially in mixed reality, like I said, where it doesn't feel like they have to learn how to use a controller or learn what the buttons are. We're kind of at that point where there's some really awesome experiences out there that VR enables that pretty much anyone can jump into, which is great. You know, my 7-year-old son, you know, I can put him in VR and he runs around and understands what to do and what the different things are. And the same goes for my father-in-law, who's, you know, a total other end of the spectrum, which is nice. Yeah, I mean, I love VR, obviously. So if anyone listening has questions or wants recommendations for games or whatever, you know, feel free to look me up, find me online. You can find me pretty much anywhere under my name. It's a unique last name, which is nice. It's easy to find me. But yeah, thank you guys very much for having me on the show.
It was a great discussion. Really, really like to hear your perspective and stories. And we appreciate you giving your time and sharing your experience.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Tune in again. And of course, as always, we welcome feedback. Thanks, everyone.